Welcome back to the Pastor's Pregame Podcast, where you'll hear the Christ Fellowship preaching team getting ready for Sunday morning. I'm your host, Lisa Scheffler, and I'm here with Senior Pastor Bruce Miller, Senior Associate Pastor Jaime Gonzalez, and Anna Campus Pastor Mark Wyatt. We are moving through the Gospel of Mark in our series, Supernatural Power. This week, we're in Mark 8, the hinge chapter for this gospel. We discuss what it means to really see Jesus for who he is, how we can be just as dense as the disciples, and what it can mean to deny yourself and follow Jesus. Hello, friends. It's Lisa coming to you from the editing room. I just wanted to let you know we had some audio issues when we recorded this episode of the podcast. So I apologize, but please keep listening. It's well worth it. The guys have some great things to say. And thank you for your patience. Welcome back, everybody. I am sitting with Jaime, Mark, and Bruce. Once again, we are all here to talk about Mark chapter 8. We are loving this Mark series. And I think this chapter in particular really is just sort of like some commentators called it a hinge. It's just really beautifully like put together and just really explains so much about what Jesus is doing and what he's going to be expecting from his disciples moving forward.
Excited to be here with you guys.
The four amigos back together.
Yes.
And amiga. And the one amiga. Amiga.
Yes.
That's my limited amount of Spanish.
Well done. Muy bien.
Mark 8, 1 through 21. During those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way, because some of them have come a long distance." His disciples answered, "But where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them?" "How many loaves do you have?" Jesus asked. "Seven," they replied. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he had taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 were present. After he had sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly, I tell you, no sign will be given to it." Then he left them, got back into the boat, and crossed to the other side. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread except for 1 loaf they had with them in the boat. "Be careful," Jesus warned them. "Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod." They discussed this with one another and said, "It is because we have no bread." Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see, and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" 12, they replied. "And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" 7, they answered. He said to them, "Do you still not understand?" Let's start with the beginning of the chapter. We have another feeding of the multitudes. This time it is 4,000 instead of 5,000. But Jaime, why do you think Mark included both stories? I mean, we're not questioning that they both happened. We believe that. But Mark included both of them in his gospel.
Yeah, I think
there are some slight differences.
Yes, there are, Lisa. Yeah, I think Mark included them to remind his readers that the good news. Remember, that's how Mark 1:1 starts. This is the good news of Jesus Christ. The good news is not just for Jewish, but it's also for the Gentiles, those who are not part of the covenant of Israel. And so the first feeding of the 5,000 was done in the Jewish territory. And it was for the feeding of the 5,000. And 12 baskets were collected, representing, in some sense, symbolizing the 12 tribes of Israel. Mm-hmm. This miracle is done on Gentile territory in the Decapolis. We read in chapter 7 that Jesus had crossed to the other side of the lake. And now he performs this miracle and he feeds 4,000 people, Gentile territory. And then 7 baskets are collected. And this is kind of like a little message of a reversal, if you will. When Israel was going into the Promised Land, they were to conquer the 7 nations of all those Ite cities. Remember the Gemanites yes, the and Ammonites, right? And they were going to destroy these people, conquer these people, and settle in this land. Well, now here, these people that were once excluded, now they're being brought back. And so there's this symbolism of 7. In fact, Mark uses the number 7 3 times in that passage. 7 baskets were left over. And these are baskets that are huge. The Greek word for basket there is a basket big enough where a human being could fit inside.
Oh, so not an Easter basket.
Not an Easter basket. In fact, Paul in Acts 13 hid in one of these baskets. And so there's this imagery of abundance, of the harvest, of many people coming to know the gospel. And so there is this contrast between these two feedings of the multitudes.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think it's interesting, Mark, you were pointing out too that yet the disciples still are a little clueless about this, about what's going
right,
on.
Right, right. So, I mean, and that's fascinating, Jaime, that brought those details. I think we see that Mark is not a haphazard book
right.
that was thrown together. And I do think that also what we see there as Jesus feeds these multitude of thousands of people before the disciples, he does include this because there is a lack of spiritual discernment as this passage unpacks itself on the disciples. And you know what? I think I relate.
I have a lack of spiritual discernment
That's right.
sometimes.
That's right. I'm just like them. So it's they don't have this discernment, but the Lord is progressively revealing himself to them.
Yeah, well, and it's even called out, when they're in the boat, right? And he says they didn't understand about the bread.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep going.
Yes,
right.
You have to keep reading in the book of Mark, and then all of a sudden you go, oh, okay. It starts to make a little more sense. Now we have Jesus. He moves from feeding the 5,000, and he has another encounter with, I'm sure, his best friends by now, the Pharisees, who are always showing up and questioning Jesus and testing him. And here they are again. Bruce, how does Jesus respond to their request for a sign?
I'm impressed once again with Mark's vulnerability and openness with Jesus' emotions. It says he sighed deeply.
Yeah.
And I can just hear his frustration, his exasperation, and his sadness over really? Mm-hmm. You're still asking me this? I just fed the 4,000 and a miracle after miracle after miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's what more do you need to see?
It's the hard-heartedness. It reminds me of people who don't really want to believe in Christ. They just want to throw up a bunch of smoke screens and objections. And it's not a real conversation.
Yeah. And really no sign would be enough for them. It's much like people nowadays will say, why didn't Jesus wait until now to come? Why wouldn't he have come and
right.
the 21st century when we have social media and we have, ways to broadcast all over the world? It's wouldn't have made any difference.
Right. That even the miracles that they did see, they didn't deny them. They actually said they were from an evil source. So it's like they didn't want to believe.
Yeah. And I think one of the commentators said, and Mark, you and I talked about this, is that the Pharisees wanted political power. They wanted their Messiah to basically kick the Romans out of their land.
Mm-hmm.
And they hated the Gentiles. They really treated them like dogs, complete sinners, unredeemable people. And Jesus had just fed them. And so he's like, look, I'm not your man. That's not the game I'm playing here. I'm doing something completely different. And you guys don't get it. And nothing I do is going to convince you of what I'm really doing. So then we move on, and he says something. That they get back in the boat. I love all these boat stories.
Yeah, they go zigzag back and forth.
Back and forth across the lake. He says, the disciples, it says, forgot to bring bread except for one loaf, which is just kind of the height of irony considering, you know, Jesus had just fed thousands of people. And they're like, oh no, what about the bread you forgot? Jesus warns them, be careful, watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. What does that mean? I mean, do we know or can we speculate? What do you think?
Well, I asked Bruce about this. Bruce's answer was really interesting. So, Bruce, what do you think?
I said I'm not 100% sure, but, you know, Lisa, when we were talking earlier, you said something about the Pharisees and Herod being so different.
Yeah.
Herod was not religious, not a moral person.
No, he murdered John the Baptist.
Yeah, and the Pharisees were very religiously oriented, very followed all the religious rules. So it appears that what's common is unbelief, that both rejected Jesus, both turned away from him. So it seems like that the yeast is that rejection. Mm-hmm. He does say in his questions to the disciples right after this, he says, are your hearts hardened?
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's not also a reflection back on Herod and the Pharisees, who both had hard hearts.
Yeah.
For different reasons. We've got to avoid that in our own lives. Mm-hmm. Avoid that. They would use the word yeast. We might use as a similar thought, poison, something small that can infect us
mm-hmm.
and really hurt us. And the more of it you get into your body, the more it's going to hurt you. And your heart can become hardened against God, against Jesus Christ.
Part of that unbelief is tied to unmet expectations. I think when you have an expectation that's wrong, it's built on a faulty premise, yet you're holding God to a standard that you created, and then you feel like he has failed you. I know a lot of people that causes them to lose their mm-hmm. faith. Something happens in their life and they're like, you know, God, I served you. I went to church. I trusted you. I prayed. I've read my Bible, and you let X happen. And then that hardens their heart because they were expecting God to be someone that God is not. And that's what they're doing. They've expected the Messiah to be something that he's not.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the hardness of heart there is what's causing the inability to see him for who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And that can happen to us as well.
Absolutely. It happens all the time, I see. And then he asks a very pointed question. He says, do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? There is this common thread through this particular chapter of this inability to perceive correctly. It's like
that's really been running through the gospel of
yeah.
who is Jesus? Do you see him? Do you hear him? Do you understand who he really is?
I think there's a little bit of hope too there because he's asking these questions to the disciples. And so, you know, I've always asked myself, when did they become, you know, true disciples? When did they really get it? Or when did they become born again? But here we see that as they're following and walking along, they're wrestling with the identity of Jesus, who he is.
Well, and I love that Jesus is asking questions.
Yeah.
I mean, he's warning them. He's asking questions. He's not, right at this point, he's not like, you guys are idiots in their face about it, right? He's just trying to get them to reflect on, you know, where are you guys at?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the whole, is these first eight chapters. He is repetitively displaying who he is, even in light of their hard understanding or their lack of spiritual perception. And I'm like, Jaime, I'm glad of that because I'm there.
Yeah.
Right. I need all the second chances,
yeah.
chances,
fifth
chances, 18th chances.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also a little message of application, more of an application for us. As we disciple and have meaningful conversations with someone, right?
Mm-hmm.
You may get frustrated. Why doesn't this person understand? Or something like that. But the call to be patient and loving and kind. That's and we have meaningful conversations.
That's a good point.
Mark chapter 8, 22 through 38. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home, saying, "Don't even go into the village." Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, and whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? Anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels."
Now, what's interesting is in the kind of the middle of this chapter, Mark 8:22, we have another miracle, but this miracle seems not only to be an actual miracle, but to have some symbolic power to it, because we've just heard Jesus say, "Do you guys not hear and see? Do you not get it?" And then they come to Bethsaida and some people bring a blind man to Jesus. He touches him and then he says, "Do you see anything?" And he says, "Well, I see some people, but they kind of look like trees." So it's not like it's a complete healing yet. And so then Jesus once more puts his hands on the man's eyes. So what's significant about this, Bruce?
Well, the disciples don't see, and now this blind man does see. And so it's a physical demonstration of sight. Now, on one level, he really does heal a blind man. Jesus has the power to heal, and he is healing this man's blindness. But it's also a picture about spiritual blindness. And the imagery of seeing and eye and sight, Hami, you were saying, is all the way through this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's 9 uses of the word, a variation of the root word of see. The Greek word in blepo, blepo, diablepo, and orao. And all these, in these small little verses, 9 times the emphasis is to see. Of Jesus doing a work in miracle in his life. Allowing them to see.
At the end, he says he saw everything clearly, which I'm like, oh, I want that. I want to see Jesus clearly, which is the call. The man could see Jesus clearly, and for all of us to see Jesus clearly, but it's a process. And what stands out is I think this is the only 2-stage miracle that Jesus does. And so he doesn't heal him all at once. And there's another image that for the disciples, they don't see Jesus clearly all at once, and neither do we. It's a process over time.
And so that leads us right into this next section, which really tests that idea of how clearly do you really see? And again, Jesus frames this as a question. You know, he doesn't stand up and say, "This is who I am. Let me spell it out for you." He asks the disciples, "Who do people say I am?" So he even gives them a little bit more distance. Like, what's the rumor about me, guys? Kind of gently leading them to this confession.
What's really funny here is that the passage about Herod, right? When he was there, they say, give the same answer. Well, you're the resurrected John the Baptist. You're Elijah. You're one of the prophets.
So this really was the rumors floating
that
around.
This is floating around. It was back then, and they're repeating these things because these things are going around. And it's getting, and it is so ironic because Jesus has, they have been sitting with Jesus throughout every, the miraculous things that he's doing, indicating who he is. And so, like you said, he's given them a safe way to get to the point. He's being gentle with them before he hammers them with the question.
Yeah, and this is a good time. I mean, Jesus is a great teacher, right? Mm-hmm. This is a great way to engage with other people. Like Jaime was saying, in your meaningful conversations, sometimes it's hard if you ask someone a direct question, what do you believe? They may not be ready for that. But if you can start with, well, what do people in our society say about Jesus? What do people you know say about Jesus? Mm-hmm. I use this all the time in Engage God Daily, by the way. I'll ask sort of more general questions just to sort of approach the subject, get your mind working, and then you go in a little more narrow. And so he says, what about you? Who do you say that I am? And who is our spokesperson?
Petras, Peter.
Peter is our spokesperson. He's the guy who speaks up. We love this about Peter. He says very clearly, you are the Messiah. So case closed, Mark ends. We close the book. It's all done, right? The disciples understand. We're good.
Right. Right.
Not quite.
Not quite. Think of being raised in the first century Judea with all the stories little boys must have told about the Messiah. Right, just the way we tell superhero stories now, they told stories about the Messiah and what it was going to be like when he came. Mm-hmm. And what do you think they were looking forward to?
They were looking forward to a conquering, victorious, military, mighty, powerful Messiah.
Yeah, and the disciples got there. They thought that was him because of all the signs they'd seen. Yeah. I mean, it's like, dude, this guy heals. He calms the storms. He feeds 5,000 people. So surely this is the guy. Because during this day and age, there were lots of would-be messiahs. It was not unusual for someone to show up, sort of an insurrectionist, showing up on the scene, proclaiming to be the Messiah. They had already, Roman already executed some would-be messiahs. So they were like, no, this really is the guy. But then what does Jesus tell them? What does he hit him with at this point?
He turns their world upside down. Their perceived enemy is something outside them, is another human, a nation, another human empire. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that's true physically speaking, but it's not the primary issue. Right. It's not the thing that Jesus came to deal with. Right. And they had, from Peter's answers, no concept of that. This just rocked them. How could you be a king and say what Jesus is about to say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He says he's going to suffer many things and killed. And then 3 days later, he's going to rise again. But that's just too much.
Just because we have to put ourselves back in that position because we know that he went to the cross.
Yeah.
They did not know that at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Mark is now finally answering the question that he gave, the comment that he made to start the book of Mark, Mark 1:1. This is the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Messiah. He's now describing what the Messiah what the Messiah looks like.
And like you say, at least when we're describing, Jaime, at least this picture of this almost superhero that's coming, this political king, military ruler who's going to establish the Jewish nation once again, like King David did. And so for Jesus to say, I'm the Messiah, now your hopes are sky high and you have these mental pictures of what that means. And he says, I'm going to suffer, be rejected, and be killed.
Wah, wah, wah.
And he's like, wait, what? That makes no sense.
No. Their minds must be spinning. And so Peter, again, the spokesperson, and one of the commentators I read said, this is probably not just Peter acting alone. He probably was speaking on behalf of many of the disciples, if not all of them, when he takes Jesus aside and says, what? First, Peter takes Jesus aside and rebukes him.
I see.
Can you imagine rebuking Jesus? That sounds like a bad idea.
Yes, it is.
Bad idea, infinitum.
Yeah. So, and what do you, can you imagine the conversation, what it might have been like? He's like, hey, Jesus, you probably shouldn't say stuff like that. Because, I mean, that can't possibly be true. I know, it, you know, it's going to be tough, this thing. But you're not, that's crazy. You're not going to die. You're the Messiah. So, come on, buck up. I mean, you can just imagine all the crazy things Peter tried to tell Jesus, the Son of God, the Eternal One.
It reminds me of the kind of things that I sometimes tell God when I try to say you're not doing it the right way. I mean, you know, whenever our life doesn't go the way we want it to go. Yeah. And we know God's in charge, and we want to tell him how to rule the world.
Yeah, we're like, here's some advice, God.
And it just seems so silly in retrospect.
So silly. So he rebukes Jesus, and then Jesus comes down hard, and he says, get behind me, Satan. He says, you do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concern. That's a pretty powerful statement.
Yeah, not exactly the encouraging words that I would like to hear from that time. Get behind me, Satan. Now, obviously, I don't think that that Peter's a personification of Satan, but these ideas are not what God has in mind. It's actually coming from the wrong place. It's he's a human success model. That's what is in his head.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and Jesus was tempted by Satan, mm-hmm. and this is probably very much echoing that temptation.
I mean, right.
We don't get a lot of that in Mark, but we get a more complete picture in Matthew. Of the temptation of Jesus. And one of those temptations was, you know, if you bow before me, I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of almost what Peter's kind of saying is, Jesus, you don't really have to go through all this really hard stuff. You could just have it all now. But that's not God's plan. That's human. That's human desires, mm-hmm. not God's desire, because God's got something much bigger in mind in saving the whole world. What is the analogy here between how the disciples act and then how this man who received sight.
When you think about it, he's partially sees, and then it takes another Jesus touching him again to heal him. Not that Jesus needed to, because Jesus could have healed him all at once, but it's two stages. Peter says, you're the Messiah. Yay. It's like he sees, and then he immediately rebukes Jesus. No, he doesn't see. Mm-hmm. And so there's a process of Peter growing in his faith.
Yeah. And there's a process for us growing in our faith.
Right.
You know, we come more and more, hopefully, as we walk alongside Jesus, we spend time in the Word, we pray, we spend time in our church community, Jesus will come more and more clearly into focus.
And I think for us to grow in having God's concerns, not human concerns, and when I read that, it makes me question, where am I confused? You know, where am I thinking on human concerns and not God's concerns in my view of Christ and my view of what success, quote unquote, looks like mm-hmm. in this life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think it's so easy for us to fall, and we've talked about this throughout Mark, but you know, crowds are fun. It's great to draw a crowd. It's great to have a lot of people going, yay, this is great, you know, and celebrating. We love that. But sometimes the success God is looking for is just being faithful to what he's called us to do. And that may be for an audience of one.
And the way forward is the way of suffering and the way of the cross.
Yeah, I don't like that. No, no, I'm kidding.
I don't think any of us do, really.
I don't either.
So he then goes from just speaking to the disciples to opening this up and talks to the whole crowd, right? So he's now ready to make some things more clear to them. What does he tell people here in 8:34 through 9:1?
Yeah, he's calling them, he's giving them a picture of what it looks like to follow him. It's interesting that when Jesus rebukes Peter, he says, get behind me. That word behind me is the same word he uses now here in verse 34. Whoever wants to be my disciple, follow behind me, they need to deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. And he gives us a series of what it looks like. To give up your life, to serve him, to follow him.
Yeah, and Bruce, do you want to share how this is structured? I think that's so beautiful.
I think there you can see what Jesus does is he draws pictures from three different realms. He says whoever would save their life will whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. So it's losing and saving, and this irony that it's actually in losing that we save. Mm-hmm. Then he shifts to commercial, economic, kind of business language, and says, what good is it for someone to gain? That word gain is like profit, to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul. It'd be a business loss. Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? And so we either can forfeit or we can gain. Mm-hmm. And then the third one is shame and glory. If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in the Father's glory with the holy angels. So the opportunity we have is to have to be saved, to have gain, and to have glory. And the possible other side is to have loss and forfeit and shame.
But you do that, you gain the positives by doing things the world looks at as negative.
Yeah. It's the upside down kingdom mm-hmm. that Jesus has. He is a king of a different mm-hmm. sort. How does he bring glory? He lays down his life instead of being this political conquering hero they're expecting. Mm-hmm. It's his reverse kingdom to us. And then we follow him in his footsteps that way. And it's completely opposite of the way I normally or my natural tendency is to be.
Yeah. Yeah. So he talks about denying yourself. So what does that look like? What does it mean to deny yourself? Just give the people some practical things to think about as we wrap this up.
Well, I think it's important to see what it's not. It doesn't mean don't eat chocolate, or it's more flipping the phrase around, denying yourself. As one of the commentators said, it's about saying, not my will, but yours be done. So it might be saying, I'm going to give up spending money on me to spend money on the kingdom, mm-hmm. or giving up time, giving up the pursuit of something in this world for the sake of something more important in the next world.
And it will always be for the greater good, for God's mm-hmm. good. It's not that Jesus calls us to self-denial for the sake of proving ourselves somehow. Because, you know, God chooses us not because we're worthy, but he makes us worthy by choosing us. And so it's always going to be ultimately for the greater gain. You're gonna gain more, and you're going to have more glory ultimately by denying yourself now in this world.
I think it oftentimes, probably in Western culture, we tend to make much of ourselves or to view yourself as a life that is successful or big. I often think of the Tower of Babel, making a name for yourself and making sure that, you know, I make my mark in this life. It's a tendency that we have that's what makes you important. And in fact, it's the opposite. Mm. If you live for that way, you actually make it a sandcastle, and it's going to be wiped away in the winds of time. And what I tend to think is God can do much more with your life than you can. And what may not seem to be a big deal, like you said, it's a lot of times we want crowds, or we want what's important, or we want to make a name for ourselves, you know?
You want the instant gratification.
Yeah. And that's not really true.
Like Easter's coming up, and we have people who are going to come put together Easter eggs.
Yeah.
For the kids. And what a wonderful thing to do. And it's serving Jesus. And there can be an element of sacrifice where you want to watch your show or do whatever your thing is. And you say, you know, instead of going to the gym or doing what I normally have planned in my calendar of what I like and what I want, I'm going to go up to the church and stuff Easter eggs for the children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, this is a great chapter. I know I feel like I say this every week, but like this one may be my favorite. Well, I don't know.
This is the hinge of the whole book right here.
Yeah. Yeah. I just love it that Jesus is being revealed for again and again, we're seeing who he is. So this was great, guys. I so appreciate all your insight and sharing it with us. So, Bruce, I think it's... let's have you pray today.
I would love to. Father, thank you for sending your Son. And Jesus, thank you for coming. You are the Messiah. And we pray that you would give us eyes to see you ever more clearly, and that we would hear your call to follow you and to realize the huge cost that is actually worth it all. And I pray that you would call us to deny ourselves and take up our crosses, that we might save our lives and experience glory with you one day. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. All right, everybody. We'll see you back next week.